Funding for Here and Now Anytime comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capella University. Capella's programs teach skills relevant to your career, so you can apply what you learn right away. See how Capella can make a difference in your life at capella.edu.
Hey there, it's Chris Bentley, host of Here and Now Anytime. Let me ask you a quick favor. It's easy, but important to me and everyone who works on this show. If you like that we're here every afternoon, bringing you fresh perspectives and insightful conversations on the big stories of the day, take 5 seconds and follow Here and Now Anytime, wherever you're listening to this podcast right now. And if you want to make us really happy and help other people find this show, leave us a good review. It really helps. And thanks. Now here's the show.
There was word last week that National Guard was on hand and was ready to be deployed if they were needed.
Police in riot gear bring pepper spray and flashbang grenades to college protests in Texas. It's Tuesday, April 30th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, an increasing number of people crossing the southern border to seek asylum in the United States are Chinese. The language barrier is one major challenge.
Sometimes they don't even know there are some resources like shelter for asylum seekers like them.
Also, we've got an ocean's bounty of new and notable video games to discuss.
If you need something that's super chill, it is just a sort of game that you vibe with, and maybe you'll learn something about fish while you do so.
That's coming up in about 20 minutes. But first, more on the anti-war protests at college campuses across the country. Dozens of people are now under arrest after police in Texas, Virginia, Utah, and New Jersey yesterday cleared campus protest sites. Students at Columbia, who overnight occupied a building to protest Israel's war in Gaza, say they will not leave until the university divests its money from Israel and grants them amnesty. In Northern California, police cleared two buildings that students were occupying at Cal Poly Humboldt. You might remember them from our episode yesterday. If you missed our conversation with a student and a dean at Cal Poly Humboldt, check out Monday's episode. And I'm going to hand it off now to Robin Young for more updates and analysis of this developing situation.
And now let's go to Texas. At least 79 anti-war student protesters were arrested on UT Austin's campus yesterday, according to the Travis County Sheriff. The students called for divestment from Israel, and they continued to protest the Israeli war against Hamas in Gaza. This is the second crackdown after police managed to clear a small encampment, only to face a larger crowd near the edge of the university's Central Mall, posting a direct challenge to both university leaders and Governor Greg Abbott. Audrey McGlinchey is a reporter with member station KUT. So, Audrey, just what's happening? Is this campus functioning as a school at all? Are people going to a class? Is this protest isolated in one part of it? What's going on?
It is pretty isolated in one part of the campus. And as far as I can tell students, I spoke with one student who finished his finals this week, and he was out at the protest yesterday. So as far as I can tell, final exams and are continuing as scheduled.
Okay, well, you were there yesterday when, as we said, at least 79 people were arrested. Let's hear a little bit from a video posted on X, Twitter, by Peter Holly, senior editor at Texas Monthly. It appears to show a student appearing to have been tear gassed.
Open your eyes! Look up! Look up! Open your eyes!
Did that happen? Is there tear gas being used?
Yes, I was there. I nearly missed, I believe it was pepper spray. We're not entirely sure, but I nearly missed it getting into my own eyes. I blocked it with my arm, but I witnessed several students, one of whom said that she had contacts in her eyes, just screaming in pain because, as anyone may know, having tear gas or even pepper spray shot into your eyes is extremely painful. So yes, at one point, police used an irritant on protesters.
Yeah, and what was the reasoning for that? Was there violence? Were they not moving? Why did they do that?
So at one point, I believe this was around 2:30 or 3 p.m., students gathered towards an exit of the campus, and they were attempting to block a van of arrested protesters. So there was a van where protesters who had been arrested were sitting in, and they were going to be taken to jail by the police. So protesters gathered to block this van from leaving campus. And in doing so, there was a standoff between protesters and police that erupted in police trying to clear and disperse the protesters so that they could leave the campus. And that resulted in what appeared to be pepper spray used and two flashbangs as well.
Yeah. Look, the school said today that most of those protesters arrested yesterday are not affiliated with the university. Is there a way to verify that?
Yeah, so the university said many of the protesters yesterday were unaffiliated with the university. We are now reporters with KUT here in Austin. We're now going about trying to verify that. So we're looking at names on arrest affidavits and running that through the University of Texas's student directory to try to see if we can verify that.
Yeah. Are there any talks between student leaders and the administration?
That I am not entirely sure of. I believe the university said they have attempted talks, but as far as I can tell, there either haven't been talks or they have not been productive.
And we mentioned the governor, Greg Abbott. You have told us that the security responding to these protests is state police, local police, and campus security. That's a lot in three different branches. Has there been any conversation about National Guard?
There has not been any conversation, but there was word last week that National Guard was on hand and was ready to be deployed if they were needed.
Yeah. Audrey McGlinchey, a reporter with member station KUT, helping us take a look at one of the colleges across the country in the midst of these protests. Audrey, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Frederick Lawrence is a former president of Brandeis University and a professor of law at George Washington University. His expertise is civil rights, free expression, bias crimes. Professor, as you're watching this unfold, what are you thinking?
Well, Robin, I'm thinking that this is a situation in which a lot more time better be spent listening than is going on right now. I think that when you back students into a corner, you often get the kind of activity that we're now seeing. So what I'm hoping can still happen is taking a page out of the book that's being used very well at a place like Northwestern, where a deal was just struck between the administration and the student protesters, allowing them to use the quad for certain purposes, restricting it for other purposes, turning off the loud noise at 12 o'clock at midnight, for example, so people can sleep and study. That kind of very sensible discussion, I'm hoping that we're going to see more of that going forward, because right now what I'm seeing is very counterproductive on a lot of our campuses.
Well, let me ask you about that, because some people see protests as very productive. They draw attention. They let people know we're serious about this. And, you know, you say that talks are good, and there are students who are looking for talks and ways to end some of these confrontations. But as you well know, there are off-campus instigators, and there are people who do believe sincerely that the attention that these protests are getting, it's worth the upset.
Upset is not what troubles me here. Protests to cause upset and raise visibility are a time-honored tradition going back to the early days of our country. What does concern me is where protest turns into acts of violence, where the university has to respond. What does concern me is peaceful protests being broken up by the excessive introduction of law enforcement too early. So I think in all those cases, that's what I mean by counterproductive.
Okay, well, now we're talking about the school side of the equation. When should police be called in? Should police be called in?
I think police should be called in as a last resort. I think prior to that, you try to do as much of this as you possibly can with campus security. And you start with the proposition that expression, including protesting expression, is one of the core values of the institution: academic freedom, free expression, free inquiry. This is the hallmark of the institution. Safety is what facilitates that. We don't exist as universities to be safe. We're safe in order to do what universities do. That's create knowledge, disseminate knowledge, and to ask hard questions and try to come up with answers to it. Mm-hmm. So when should a university clamp down on expression? Where there's actual threats, where there's actual assaults, and where there is actual interference with the operation of the university. Mm-hmm. That leaves a wide range for protesting behavior to go forward, including behavior that makes people uncomfortable, that may even be inconvenient. That shouldn't be restricted.
No.
What should be restricted is actual threats, actual interruption with the way in which the university has to function.
What about free speech? It does make people uncomfortable. When does it cross over into being dangerous?
I think it becomes dangerous when you're actually in the context of real threats. If you're short of threats, speech that challenges, speech that even provokes, it can be very unpleasant to listen to this. I don't want to understate that. But at the end of the day, that is the cost of living in a free society and living in a democracy, that people hear things that perhaps they wish they hadn't heard. Mm. That's different from threatening people. That's where it crosses the line.
Well, what about the chant from the river to the sea? The ACLU says that pro-Palestinian protesters chanting this is free speech, but many Jewish people say it calls for the destruction of Israel, and it makes them feel threatened, that they see it as violent and threatening.
The best way to figure out whether something is threatening is to look first and foremost at what is the intent of the speaker. If the speaker is saying things that are designed to threaten, that's one thing. I think from the river to the sea means lots of things to lots of different people. Some people do mean it in a threatening way, and I think that's one thing. Some people mean it to say that they believe that the Palestinian people have certain rights that haven't been respected, and I think that's a view that certainly is one you can agree with, disagree with, but you couldn't say is threatening.
And this is going to spark a lot of conversation. I know we'll continue to have it, but what about amnesty in the few seconds we have? If a student is suspended or expelled, should that follow them through their lives? Would you grant amnesty to the occupiers of the buildings, for instance, who are asking for it?
I'd like to know a lot more about how we got to the situation of a building being occupied, but I think you do best in these situations by beginning with the understanding that the students are not they, the students are we. There's only one entity here, it's the university. The students, the faculty, the staff, the administration are all part of the same entity. And that once you start with that proposition, you're looking for solutions. Universities don't exist to punish. They don't exist to discipline. Sometimes we have to punish. Sometimes we have to discipline. But that's not the core mission. The core mission is to educate. And so I think that universities would do very well to try to find their way through all of these situations in a way that reduces the tension and doesn't incite the tension.
Get to the teachings on the other side. Frederick Lawrence, former president of Brandeis, thank you.
Pleasure being with you.
Coming up next, we'll hear why more Chinese migrants are crossing into the United States at the southern border, and what awaits them when they get here. Deepa Fernandez has the story when we return.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, the automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy explains how Betterment's technology helps investors better understand and save on taxes.
So taxes are a real cost of investing, as are fees. Understanding your after-tax, after-fee returns is really what's important for investors. An example would be when you buy and sell securities frequently, you can pay a lot of taxes because short-term capital gains, meaning I bought it and I sold it fairly quickly, have higher taxes than long-term capital gains. Our technology in particular will tell you what the tax implication of a particular move you'd like to make is going to be before you make that move so that you're making it with full transparency.
Learn more at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance not guaranteed.
Support for NPR and the following message come from the Lemelson Foundation, dedicated to improving lives through invention, innovation, and climate action.
Let
the number of Chinese migrants crossing the southern border has been increasing. According to US officials, last year about 37,000 migrants from China came across the border from Mexico. That's 10 times more than crossed the year before. The Chinese citizens are flying into Ecuador and travelling north through the Darien Gap, the same path that millions of other migrants travel. China's slowing economy and repressive political policies are some of the reasons they're coming here. April Xu is a reporter for Documented, a non-profit news site that covers the immigrant community in New York. She's been speaking to some recent Chinese migrants there, and she joins us now. April, welcome.
Hi, Deepa.
So, April, who is coming to the United States from China this way? What kind of lives are they leaving behind there?
According to my observation, like for the people I have talked to, they're from various backgrounds. Some are more like a middle-class family. Some are in their 30s, very young people, and they actually not in a very good financial situation. They have to borrow some loans to support their journey to the U.S.
And why are they coming through South and Central America, through the very dangerous Darien Gap? Did they tell you anything about that?
Actually, they chose that route because that's the information they gathered from online. They call it Zouxian, which means walk the line. The Chinese migrants I have interviewed, they told me they first just saw a random video on Douyin, the Chinese version of TikTok, about walk the line. And they were just like curious about the content. They have never seen such content before. And once they saw the first video, you know, the app just pushed them more similar content. And that's how they found the route.
And once they get to the United States, is the intention to apply for asylum?
Yes, because that's probably the major way for them to stay in the U.S.
And what happens when Chinese migrants arrive in, say, New York City? You profiled one man who came to New York City because he was swindled out of money in Los Angeles.
Yes, I think among the Chinese migrants, they think New York City is more migrant-friendly, and because of the public transit system, it's easier for them to, you know, move around. And they think, like, in New York City, there are several Chinese communities where they can survive without speaking English.
And April, does that come true when they arrive in New York City? You know, is it an easy transition for them? Are there any challenges Chinese migrants face?
Yes. Actually, many of them, after they arrive in New York City, they realize that the dangerous journey is not the only challenge. Because of the influx of Chinese migrants, they're actually facing fierce competition among migrants. It's hard for them to find nice housing and job opportunities. One lady told me that in the first week when she arrived in New York City, she made about like 30 phone calls to just find the house where her family of four can stay. And once the agent or landlord heard that she is a migrant with kids, they immediately rejected her.
And there is a shelter system in New York for arriving migrants. I think we often think most of the migrants who are coming are from Central America and speak Spanish. I'm just wondering, the social services that are available for migrants, do they easily kind of translate for Chinese migrants? Are they able to use the system?
I think from the Chinese migrants I interviewed, they all kind of feel like it's hard for them to get those information in Chinese. Sometimes they don't even know there are some resources like shelter for asylum seekers like them.
And you reached out to New York City officials in the mayor's office. Did you get any response about meeting the needs, particularly in Chinese language information, so that this particular group can be served better?
They mentioned they are trying to increase the capacity to meet the language needs among migrants. If the city can allocate more fundings for the community-based organization, which already have the language services and already, you know, have the trust among the Chinese migrants, it will definitely help. And if they can also translate the current, you know, available resources provided by the city into Chinese, because they also mentioned that they really want to get official information from the government about what the trustworthy lawyers or like trustworthy organization they can turn to, because during this journey they run into many like scammers or traps and they don't know who they can trust.
You reported that there were some people who even found it so hard in New York City that they went back to China. What makes it so hard?
Basically, the major reason is the language barriers and the lack of social network. Actually, Chinese migrants mentioned that compared to the migrants from Latin Americans who can speak Spanish, it's easier for those Latin American migrants to find a job or like start like social network here in the U.S. Because Spanish is also like a very popular language here. For Chinese migrants, many of them, they don't speak a word of English. And if they got trapped just in the Chinese community, which have also limited capacity to accommodate so many newly arrived migrants, it's very hard for them to survive, especially if you don't have a work permit and if you don't have any source of income.
April Xu is a reporter for Documented, a nonprofit news site that covers the immigrant community in New York City. April, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Head to hereandnow.org for more stories about immigration. Yesterday, we took a closer look at that dangerous passage in Central America, the Darien Gap, and the realities for people who feel they have no choice but to cross it on foot.
We spoke with dozens and dozens and dozens of people who were literally just finishing this route. And during that time, more than 70 of them told us that they had been the victims of violent assaults, really violent robberies, really holdups in the jungle.
You can find that whole conversation and a lot more at hereandnow.org. Coming up, James Mastro Marino is back with new video game recommendations and one video game controversy to discuss. This time, the games are on the chill end of the spectrum, so kick back, relax, and float along with us after the break.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Vuori. Jump into a new perspective on performance apparel. Vuori makes products that stand the test of time and hope to inspire others to live vibrant, healthy lives, empowering your best life in clothing that can be worn for just about any activity from running to yoga. Visit Vuori.com/NPR to receive 20% off your first purchase and enjoy free shipping on any U.S. orders over $75. Discover the versatility of Vuori clothing. This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's TELADOC health/whatsyourwhy. This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive, and it's Name Your Price tool. Say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show coverage options within your budget. Visit Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Here and Now's resident gamer recently noticed a bevy, you might say a raft, of new nautically themed video games making a splash this month.
Should I go get more help?
Let's not be hasty about telling anyone else yet.
You take the next. I'll take care of this side.
See you in the open ocean, treasure hunters.
For the new, the notable, and the weird, let's talk games with James. It's James Mastro Marino. Ahoy there.
Ahoy, ahoy, Chris.
All right, so you insisted that I lead with the seafaring analogy. As I understand it, you've been playing a lot of new games with a nautical theme. So let's start with Harold Halibut, which is a sci-fi adventure game.
After 200 years, we finally arrived at our destination, only to find that the promising, watery planet contained no habitable landmass and dense, toxic gases in the atmosphere. Hardly the second Earth we had hoped for.
All right. Waterworld. Nice. Sounds pretty far out. Tell us about this.
Yeah, exactly. So Harold Halibut is like this retro futuristic game. You play the very same titular Harold Halibut, a fix-it guy on this underwater space colony. And this colony came from a generation ship that left Earth during the height of the Cold War, crash-landed on this underwater world, and has been trying to get by ever since. Naturally, there's all sorts of shenanigans afoot. And the real selling point here isn't this like glacially paced story. It's rather the aesthetic, which it looks like a stop motion animated film like The Fantastic Mr. Fox or Wallace and Gromit or Chicken Run or something. They made all of these character models and sets out of real wood and fabric and clay, but then they digitized them and used computer magic to do the actual animating. So playing it feels like you're playing through one of these movies. And that's kind of my only critique, is that it is paced very slowly, and the story might have been able to be contained within like a feature-length film worth of time. Nonetheless, it's a fascinating artistic endeavor.
Huh. Yeah, it sounds beautiful. Sounds like Avatar, The Way of Water or something, although probably didn't cost $1 billion.
Much more twee. Yes, exactly. Think indie art project.
Nice. So your next pick doesn't feature any human characters at all. It's called Another Crab's Treasure. And you're telling me that this is like a cute version of Elden Ring?
Yeah, it sells itself as a Souls-like, which is these really tough action role-playing games that have sort of taken over a lot of the video game space for the past, nearly 15 years-ish. You play a bereft little hermit crab in this incredibly cute and colorful ocean. Your shell gets repossessed by a loan shark, so you go on a quest to find it. And along the way, the core mechanic is that there are around 100 other shells that, with a press of a button, you can pop into. Those shells will give you defensive capabilities. They'll also give you the access to kind of magical abilities, and you'll fight your way through this grand ocean. It is about as accessible as one of these styles of games can possibly be. So, Chris, I know I've kind of you've started to dip your toes into this genre with games like Bloodborne. It's like that,
yes,
but everyone is like a bikini bottom, like cute SpongeBob sort of character. And that's not to say that there isn't some darkness. There's microplastics and pollution and something crazy going on with the denizens of this ocean, but the number of times where I've just shouted while playing this game is so good, has been more than I can count in one hand.
That sounds fun. It's like not every game can or should be so oppressively dark as a lot of these.
I think that's what's so cool about it, is that it carries over a lot of the mechanical ideas and even some of the like thematic ones while being so colorful and approachable and funny. It does not take itself too seriously.
Well, maybe I will get around to that when I actually finish Elden Ring, which I did just start for the first time. So hold all my calls.
Yeah, good luck. That might take you a year.
One more underwater game you got for us today. Nintendo's coming out with Endless Oceans Luminous this week. Let's hear a bit of that.
Welcome to the Veiled Sea. This region of the ocean changes every time you dive.
You got to play this one early, and now you're finally allowed to talk to us about it. I guess my childhood point of reference for this is kind of like Echo the Dolphin. But I guess today's graphics probably make it closer to a nature documentary, like Blue Planet in video game form. Tell us about this.
Yeah, I mean, it is on the Nintendo Switch. You're not going to get something that's like photorealistic.
Sure,
but it does
sure.
feel a little bit like a 1990s edutainment game. This is actually a remake from a game that came out decades ago. But the point is that you get to do these dives, and you'll get to scan all manner of sea life. Many of them are real fish or prehistoric fish. And then as you scan them, it'll pop up basically like a Pokedex entry and tell you, wow, you've gotten this thing and here's what they were and what they do. The twist is that there are also like fantastical variant species you'll encounter. Usually they'll unlock after you do a certain number of things and you're treated to some sort of like wondrous display of a fish that doesn't really exist but is based on something that does. And then you can also play it with up to 30 people online. So Nintendo gave me the chance to do this. And while none of us were like in a voice server together, it was still really fun to just sort of like scout the ocean, trawl the seafloor for treasure, find crazy fish and like use emotes to point them out to folks. But if you need something that's super chill, it is just a sort of game that you vibe with, and maybe you'll learn something about fish while you do so.
Oh, cool. I'm reminded a little bit of that game Dredge that I know you loved. I did too last year.
I love Dredge.
A horror fishing game. Also pretty chill.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe a quarter of those fish are real and the rest are Lovecraftian nightmares.
Exactly. all right. I love a theme, obviously, but there was something else that you wanted to talk about that's decidedly non-nautical. Stellar Blade, which is a PlayStation exclusive published by Sony. There's some kind of culture war controversy going on around this game, but I have not followed it, so why don't you fill us in?
Yeah, let's dive in. The first thing you need to know about Stellar Blade is that it is a very competent, very stylish action game like Bayonetta or Sekiro Shadows Die Twice or Nier Automata. If you don't know what those are, it's just a fast, slick game. It also happens to have an overtly sexualized main player character, and that's where some of the furor has erupted, because there is a recent contingent of online gamers that feel like this once staple of games, the sexy female main character, has gone away. And here's one example of an unabashedly objectified character, and they've rallied around it. The furor around it will die down, and there are many games like it that have had similar characters before, notably Bayonetta, but it's become a rallying cry for a particularly problematic subset of gamers.
Oh, boy. All right, here and now producer and NPR gaming lead James Mastromarino, also the author of the Substack, Games with James. James, always good to talk to you. Thanks.
Thanks, Chris.
Our show, Here and Now Anytime, comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Koyani Saxena, Lynn Menegon, Julia Corcoran, and James Mastromarino. Today's editors were Ahmad Daman, Peter O'Dowd, Micaela Rodriguez, Michael Scotto, and Kat Welch. Technical direction from Mike Moschetto and Caleb Green. Mike Moschetto also wrote our theme music, along with Max Liebman and me, Chris Bentley. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin, and the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch. Support for NPR and the following message come from Rosetta Stone, the perfect app to achieve your language learning goals no matter how busy your schedule gets. It's designed to maximize study time with immersive 10-minute lessons and audio practice for your commute. Plus, tailor your learning plan for specific objectives like travel. Get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off and unlimited access to 25 language courses. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
Last year, over 20,000 people joined the Body Electric study to change their sedentary, screen-filled lives. And guess what?
We saw amazing effects.
Now you can try NPR's Body Electric Challenge yourself. Listen to updated and new episodes wherever you get your podcasts.